Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. I am here with John, and my name is Jamie.
That's new us. Intro, bro. It hits hard.
I played air guitar just now. I don't know if you caught it.
I saw it. I'm looking at how much sleep I had last night.
Could have used you on the air drums.
Sorry, ma'am.
Oh, good. Did you sleep okay?
Apparently.
I fell asleep listening to a podcast about what we're going to be talking about for the next 2 weeks.
Not a great start. Not a good sales pitch.
Oh, no, it's a great podcast, but I also just have been sleeping a lot, so it's no reflection on the podcast, just that I've been listening to this subconsciously, so it's deep in my brain.
I wish that I could do that, like listen to historical information while I sleep and yet somehow retain that information. I could just learn stuff while I sleep. That would be incredible.
That would be awesome. We'd get so much more done and wouldn't really need to have the need for school anymore.
That'd I could be, great. Be a doctor, you know? I could just go to sleep reading pre-med and medical books. Anyway, that turned into a weird conversation. We are here to talk about some crime, but before we do, I have a new Patreon, Jamie, that I would like to thank, a new Patreon member. Do you have some ratings and reviews you're going to read as well?
While you're pulling that up?
No.
Oh, okay.
So I don't have a name. But it's new member 080224.
You know who you are.
We didn't plan that. But no, new member came in at the elite level. That's the highest level you can get. And they took advantage of the annual membership and saved some moolah. So thank you so much. And yeah, we got an autographed picture. They've picked a couple of episodes. One of them, Jamie, is Mags Bennett from the movie or the series Justified, which is from your hometown.
She's based on a real person, not last name Bennett. Yes, name Mags. We'll see if
I'm not mistaken, Mags Bennett from the Justified series is actually Mags Bailey, which is my last name.
It is actually, I wasn't ready to say that, but there we are.
But I can assure you we are not related.
Are you sure?
I mean, if so, it's very, very distant. I know my entire family lineage on the Bailey side.
You could be rich if it is, because a famous bootlegger involved in a lot of local politics in southeastern Kentucky. So that's a case recommended by this user from across the pond. We really appreciate your support. I've got two new 5-star reviews that came in this week, actually. This comes from RapMon3. Amazing podcast. Came back to edit my review because you finally changed the theme music again, and it's so much better. Thank you so much. You're right. It's much more you guys than the cheesy 80s cop show music. Great job. Keep up the good work. Did you write that, John?
Oh, no, I didn't.
Okay. This is from i10 user. Jamie and John do an excellent job telling true crime stories. I've been binging from the start, and I'm up to August 2022. My favorite episode was Michael Malloy.
Michael Malloy.
Sad story, but love the commentary about the alcohol and needing to find new friends.
I'm going to be honest. I don't remember Michael Malloy off the top of my head. I'd have to Google it.
I mean, we have done 7 years worth of episodes, and some of them do run together. And I think it's fascinating when people bring things up and I'm like, oh yeah, that one sticks out in my mind. Or other times like this, I'm like, wow, I need to go back and check that one out.
I'll Google it.
We are excited today to start a journey talking about the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr.
Don't get turned off yet and tune away, because today we're going to talk about the facts of the case. Next week, there's some, I didn't realize, Jamie, how much information and conspiracy theories there are. And as we've researched this independently, I think there's a lot to it, and I think it's really fascinating and really interesting to discuss. So hang with us these couple of weeks.
We're going to approach this just as we did the JFK assassination, which happened, you know, in the same decade or so. So we're going to talk about it in the same way. We're going to have this episode where we give kind of the facts of what happened. What do we know happened? And then next week we'll talk into the theories of what else may have happened behind the scenes. We talk so much about the JFK assassination. There are tons of documentaries. Not as much out there on this one, but at least for the, I hate to use the word conspiracy, but at least for the conspiracy theories, I find this one more intriguing of the possibilities.
I agree. So let's get started. Martin Luther King Jr. was born on January 15th, 1929. I don't think in my mind that he was that old. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like that's pre-World War II.
Yeah, well, so, I mean, he was in his 30s when he died, so that we only have an image of young King, I think.
Yeah. So he was the second of three sons born to Michael King Sr. and Alberta King. At only 15 years old, King was admitted to Morehouse College after passing the entrance exams as a high school junior. While at Morehouse, he would join the Alpha Pi Alpha, which is the oldest black fraternity in the U.S., while he began his studies in law and medicine, he would eventually change directions after crossing paths with Benjamin Elijah Mays, who was a minister and president at Morehouse at that time. King's family had a deep connection to religion, and his father was a minister as well. And while it was a path that King had never intended to follow, after Mays became his spiritual mentor and passed on many of his teachings, King would go on to earn a bachelor's degree in sociology at Morehouse, a bachelor's of divinity in theology at Cozier, and that was a theological seminary. And he would also earn a PhD in systemic theology from Boston University. While earning his PhD, he would meet Coretta Scott, the woman who he would end up marrying. And they would eventually settle down in Montgomery, Alabama, where King would become the pastor of the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church.
In 1954, the monumental Brown versus the Board of Education case ruling that desegregation of schools should happen led to a mounting movement in which black Americans wanted to see other aspects of the Jim Crow laws be undone. This mounting protest would lead to King meeting another influential figure in the movement, Rosa Parks. King would find his leadership role within the movement after he was chosen to lead the Montgomery Improvement Association, and that's the group that organized the Montgomery bus boycott. After the successful boycott, King would be invited to similar efforts across the country, specifically in Atlanta. There, he joined a group of 60 other civil rights leaders and pastors to create the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and he became its first president. It's known as the SCLC, and that group adopted a nonviolent strategy to deal with segregation. They tried to open their door to the aid of people from all backgrounds, regardless of religion or race. On April 12th of 1863, King would be arrested for demonstrating without a permit while protesting on Good Friday alongside 50 others from the organization. While he was in prison, King would create a core document to the civil rights movement as he wrote the famous letter from Birmingham jail in the margins of a smuggled newspaper, and he actually wrote it right beside an article that was criticizing the protests. From Birmingham, King would go on to lead the SCLS in partnership with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the SNCC, to shepherd such events as the March on Washington and the March on Selma. In 1964, the Civil Rights Act was signed by President Lyndon B. Johnson, and in 1965, he signed the Voting Rights Act. So it seemed that the movement was gaining traction, and it was making a difference in the lives of some Americans. 2 years after the passing of the Voting Rights Act, King and the SCLC would change focus to closing the wage gap between black and white American workers, and they noted this as the Poor People's Campaign. Martin Luther King Jr. has become one of, if not the most influential figure of the modern civil rights movement. Most people look at him as a figure of courage, peace, power, leadership, and ultimately, sacrifice. At the time, though, King was very unpopular. Many Americans opposed his method for change, his ideas, the marching. But he said he knew what he was doing had to be done in order to combat the injustice happening in America. King knew his methods would get both admiration, but also a lot of hatred for people. As early as the mid-1950s, King was already getting death threats, and he was nearly fatally stabbed in 1958. After JFK's assassination in 1963, while watching the footage on television, he leaned over to his wife, Coretta, and said, "This is what's going to happen to me also. I keep telling you, this is a sick society." What a prophecy there. King fought for change, even though he knew he might not ever get to see it. And this is a quote that he gave at Mason Temple on April 3rd of 1968. This was his final speech in Memphis. "I've been to the mountaintop. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we, as a people, will get to the promised land."
Dude, isn't it crazy? I mean, you said it a while ago, and I didn't want to interrupt you, but the Voting Rights Act, that was in 1964. And if you remember what happened 100 years before that, well, that was the end of the Civil War. So it took 100 years for voting rights to be established for African Americans. And in my mind, it's insane that we as a country were just, we moved very slowly. So I really admire everything that MLK did. And but I also think it's a shame that he even had to, in a way, right. You know, like I feel like it should just be common sense. But anyway.
Yeah. It's, again, it's fascinating to think about how he was viewed at the time versus how he's viewed now, and how much of that is just due to the passage of time, and how much of it is due to people realizing, yeah, he was right.
Yeah. King's mind was most likely dwelling on the possibility of his assassination during his speech, as his flight to Memphis had been delayed due to a targeted bomb threat. King would go on only a few moments later to close his speech with the famous quote, "I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen glory of the coming of the Lord," end quote. And he was giving this quote because there was a sanitation strike happening in Memphis. And the strike was spurred on after two Memphis sanitation workers, whose names were Echol Cole and Robert Walker, were killed because of a faulty garbage truck compressor. Now, city officials refused any sort of dialogue with protesters, so this strike would continue on for 12 full days, which, because of the strike, crippled the sanitation department. And this caused tensions to only rise. So basically, you've got a city who needs their trash picked up, and no one's picking it up for over a week.
Yeah, and a lot of it's just due to treating the workers poorly, specifically the African-American workers, and obviously it really took off. You mentioned being killed in a faulty, like they were crushed inside a garbage truck. Like it was a brutal, horrible death, so that's what really got this going.
King had shown support for the strikes as early as February that year, and then he took part in a massive march in Memphis on March 28th, 1968. And it was just to show the full support of the SCLC, and King agreed to lead that march. Memphis stopped completely as thousands took to the streets to hold signs. Some of them read, "I am a man." King was expected to speak at the end of that march. When violence began to erupt, there were anywhere from 5,000 to 8,000 protesters against 700 police officers, which was the entire force. Like they called everyone out, and it was 700 police officers against 5,000 to 7,000 protesters. And a group of the younger men, not members of the protest, had taken a chance to break windows along the path that they were marching on, which gave the assembled police a cause to approach and shut down the march through force, beating down many not involved in the damages, and used tear gas to control the crowds. So this has turned into a situation. You know, you have the people that are marching peacefully, and then there's another group who are going behind them or amongst them and causing chaos. How do you as a police officer differentiate the two when you're trying to maintain order. I don't
absolute mess. Yeah,
it's a mess, and sadly, we've seen some of this happen in the last 10 years.
Yeah,
it's not something that's stopped in Memphis.
Some really bad ones in Louisville in the last couple of years here in Kentucky.
Yeah.
And by bad ones, I mean peaceful protests that some people took the wrong direction and ended up getting people hurt.
Yeah. The SCLC ministers saw that this conflict was happening, so they surrounded King and moved him to an undisclosed location. At 7 p.m. to 5 a.m., curfew was put in place soon after the march turned into a riot, and it concluded because of the curfew. Anyone walking the streets without reason would be arrested. Additionally, the governor called for the support of the National Guard. By 4 o'clock a.m., over 4,000 armed troops were in Memphis, and their general stated that they were prepared to fire. So this is going, in my mind, beyond restoring peace. This is, we're going to eliminate and cause peace that way.
Yeah.
Eliminate the problem by not taking them to jail, but by killing them.
We talked to her about Ruby Ridge last week, and I think this is a similar situation. They're looking not only to stop the protest, but to send a message to prevent other protests, is the feeling I get here.
On March 28th, the next morning, there was a member of a different civil rights organization that was not connected to King, and they alluded that it was all planned. And King, at a press conference, explains that the SCLC had nothing to do with the riot that occurred. Small conflicts continued, but King maintained his position and belief in a nonviolent approach. King would briefly travel to Atlanta, but would return to Memphis on April 3rd to deliver the aforementioned speech that at the Mason Temple, the world headquarters of the Church of God in Christ. King recounted the 1958 attempt assassination and how if he had moved at all, even sneezed, the blade of the knife would have pierced his aorta. And because he didn't sneeze, he got to see and aid in years of progress for the civil rights movement. He also looked back on his recent bomb threat with almost prophetic clarity, delivering both the previously mentioned quotes and his final 30 seconds on his speech. He may not get to see the promised land, but he's not afraid.
We're going to take a short break, and when we get back, we'll talk about the details of the assassination and what we think may or may not have happened to Dr. King. Luther King Jr. in Memphis during this trip was staying at the Lorraine Motel, and on April 4th, 1968 at 6 p.m., which was about 22 hours after he had given his final speech, he came back to the motel. During his time in Memphis, he had become known for staying at room 306 at the Lorraine Motel. Reverend Ralph Abernathy, a colleague and close friend of King, told the House Select Committee on Assassinations that they stayed in room 306 so often that it had come to be colloquially known as the King Abernathy Suite. King's final known words were to popular jazz musician Ben Branch. King knew that Branch had a big performance in the next few hours, and he had a request. "Ben, make sure you play Take My Hand, Precious Lord in the meeting tonight. Play it real pretty." At 6:01 p.m., King had been leaning over the motel's secondary story railing while speaking to Reverend Jesse Jackson below when he was struck in the face by a .30-06 Springfield round fired from a Remington Model 760 rifle at a distance of about 206 feet, and he went sprawling backwards. Reverend Samuel Kiles was standing only a few feet away from King when this happened, and he saw King being hit by the round. The bullet entered through King's right cheek, breaking his jaw and then several vertebrae as it traveled down his spinal cord, severing his jugular vein and major arteries before lodging finally in his shoulder. The force of the shot alone was enough to rip King's necktie loose from him, and King was completely unconscious before he even hit the ground. Ralph Abernathy, rushed outside to find King bleeding profusely from the wound in his cheek. Andrew Young, who's another colleague from the SCLC, said he at first believed King was dead, but he did manage to find a pulse. King was immediately rushed to St. Joseph's Hospital, where medical staff both opened his chest and performed CPR, but King would never regain consciousness. His time of death officially was 7:05 p.m., over an hour after he was shot. King's autopsy revealed that his heart was in the condition of a 60-year-old man, even though he was only 39 at the time, and his friends and family really attributed that to the stress of being in charge of the civil rights movement for so long. While he was taken to the hospital, tactical teams and police descended on the area around the motel. They learned on the scene that the shot was fired from a brick building on the direct east side of the Lorraine Motel. Another officer discovered a bag close to the brick building that included a rifle and a pair of binoculars. Both would later be fingerprinted and tracked back to the man who was identified as the shooter. Witnesses at the Lorraine and on the ground pointed to a man that they had seen fleeing south on Main Street. Police pursued, but they didn't catch up to this guy that day. This wasn't a Lee Harvey Oswald situation. At 8 p.m., almost an hour after he was pronounced dead, presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy arrived in Indianapolis as a part of his campaign tour. Kennedy was the first person to tell a broader audience that King had died, and recordings of that event show the great anguish that spread through the crowd. But Kennedy continued, "For those of you who are black and are tempted to be filled with hatred and mistrust of the injustice of such an act against all white people, I would only say that I can also feel in my own heart the same kind of feeling. I had a member of my family killed, but he was killed by a white man. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but it's love and wisdom and compassion toward one another, and a feeling of justice toward those who still suffer in our country." And of course, we know that Robert Kennedy would also be assassinated not long after this. Colleagues of King in the civil rights movement did their best to call for a nonviolent response. Obviously, this did cause a great deal of uproar. Dr. Benjamin Hooks from the NAACP insisted everyone in Memphis stay in their homes, but instead of breaking windows, rooting, rioting, that they should go to their knees and pray to God that we might live for the things that Martin Luther King Jr. died for. Police in Memphis were out searching for what they believed to be a well-dressed man seen leaving a brick building across from the Lorraine Motel, as well as a white Mustang that they thought he may have been driving. Despite all attempts to maintain peace after the assassination, conflicts boiled over into the streets. Fires began cropping up throughout the city, looting was happening, and both angered protesters and police officers were shot and injured during these events. President Johnson would go on to deploy about 13,000 armed troops in Washington to stop rioters from reaching the White House. Washington, D.C., New York City, Chicago, Baltimore, Louisville, Kentucky, and Kansas City all turned to chaos. It was a nationwide outpour. Violence erupted across the nation, and 30 more lives were claimed as a result of these events.
So let's talk about the hunt for this man or the person responsible. So now it's April the 5th, 1968, and the shooter has evaded police, but they do have a suspect. An international manhunt is about to begin. The rifle, bullet, binoculars have all been uncovered by the police, and there were several fingerprints and palm prints that were left on those items, as well as around the hotel room, which was used as the sniper's nest. And this led to them identifying an escaped convict named James Earl Ray as the potential person responsible for murdering Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. President Lyndon B. Johnson declares the 7th of April as a national day of mourning, on which the U.S. flag would be flown at half staff. On the 8th, his wife, Miss King, and her four children had a crowd that estimated at 40,000 people, and they were led on a silent march through the streets of Memphis. On the 9th, over 300,000 people attended Dr. King's funeral. And then a couple days later, on the 11th, President Johnson signed a civil rights bill, and this bill would outlaw discrimination in housing and introducing protections for the rights of all civil workers. While the nation mourned, worked, and raged, Ray was still on the run. Finally, on June 8th, 2 months after King's assassination, police arrested James Earl Ray in Hearthrow, London.
He actually escaped to Canada and then was able to fly to London, but certainly halfway across the world before they caught up to him.
They were able to use his fingerprints to identify Ray, and the FBI expanded their search across all 50 states and beyond. They were searching Canada, Mexico, Portugal, England, and many other countries. Ray was detained in the airport in Hearthrow based on the fact that he had forged his passport, and upon further investigation, they were able to find that he was also carrying a concealed weapon. Ray was then extradited to Tennessee and charged with King's murder. 2 days later, on March 10th, 1969, Ray confessed to the assassination of Dr. King.
There is controversy about whether or not he actually confessed. He did end up pleading guilty, which we'll get to later. His attorney at this time was Percy Foreman. Now, he originally had two other attorneys before Percy Foreman just kind of came in and took over, which will lead to some other conspiracies. He took a guilty plea to avoid the death penalty. And with a guilty plea, you have to say you did it. So they had that on the books. They were able to avoid a full trial being put on and bringing all this back up in front of our nation, even though Ray would later recant his plea and his confession unsuccessfully. He was sentenced to 99 years in prison. Ray would go on to fire his representation before claiming there was another man going by the name Raul who was involved with this. He claimed that it was actually Raul and Ray's brother Jimmy who were involved in the killing of King and not Ray himself. Through an attorney, Ray argued that he did not personally shoot Martin Luther King Jr., though he may have been partially responsible of it happening without knowing it. In May of 77, Ray's new legal counsel presented evidence to attempt to exonerate their client. But the House Select Committee on Assassinations found the submission baseless and not conclusive and was denied. In June of that same year, Ray attempted to escape Brushy Mountain State Penitentiary with seven other inmates. But like we talk about with most of our escapes, John, it was short-lived. They were all captured and put back in jail, and a year was added to Ray's sentence. Now serving 100 years instead of 99, he's not going to see either of those, obviously. Ray and his team would continue to work right up until his death, trying to get his name cleared, trying to withdraw his guilty plea. And believe it or not, John, in 1997, Martin Luther King Jr.'s son, Dexter, met with James Earl Ray and then publicly supported Ray, saying he was innocent and deserved a new trial. Before that ever happened, James Earl Ray died in prison on April 23rd of 1998 at the age of 70 from liver failure caused by hepatitis C. It was not conclusively determined how Ray got this infection, but it did lead to his death. At this point, Ray has been dead for almost 30 years, but people still talk about conspiracies surrounding the death of Martin Luther King Jr. Many believe that there are facts that don't quite add up about his murder. There are tensions that are left unanswered, motives that aren't explained, that was never cleared up in James Earl Ray's case. While this world won't soon forget what Martin Luther King Jr. has done, how his leadership shaped a movement, and how his sacrifice changed the country, the mystery still remains. With a shooter brought to justice, why has the King family, while doing their best to preserve Dr. King's legacy, spent the last five decades arguing one point? They continue to claim that James Earl Ray did not kill Martin Luther King Jr. does the opinion, and we're going to go into more of this next week. We're going to break into the theories, why theories are out there, and how much justification there is for them. But does his family supporting the idea that Ray was innocent move the needle at all for you just on the surface, John?
I think that I need to really understand the why behind that before I give a definitive answer. But most families, well, all families want justice when something like this has happened, right? And if the family is saying, we don't believe that this guy killed our loved one, therefore there is no justice yet, I'm intrigued, to say the least.
And I'm more apt to continue digging as a curious individual, as I would hope as law enforcement. And there have been investigations over time. There was another attorney that Ray teamed up with that actually went on to partner with Dexter King to work on some of this stuff. There was actually essentially what was a public trial with no legality to it. Judge Joe Brown is involved in these appeals from the old TV show. Like this, there is so much here that I think people don't know, because more so than Lee Harvey Oswald, which again, all kinds of theories still flying around about that one. I feel like most people believe this was open and shut, and it's not as open and shut as what people believe.
Well, I am certainly intrigued to learn more. So I, for one, am excited about next week's episode.
I'm excited as well. I'm excited to know your opinion once we dig into all the evidence. I have I founded my opinion on this a few years ago, and I feel pretty strongly about it, what really happened. And I think it'll be fun to get your thoughts. And we recognize that we are two white dudes here talking about the assassination of an African-American civil rights leader. There is an element of this that's going to be lost on us because of how we grew up and the fact that our skin's a different color. We just want to acknowledge that as we continue to dig in to the details behind the story and what we think happened.
Yeah. So I can't say that any better. While he is so important to me, and I have listened to pretty much every speech I could find, and I love his work. I think he as a human was incredible. But I still feel like I'm not able to fully appreciate everything he did.
Absolutely. And hopefully through next week's discussion, we'll get more into some other reasons that people may have wanted him dead and what we think, where the evidence leads to the plausible options of what may have happened if it wasn't just James Earl Ray pulling up, shooting him and leaving his gun there in a bag and flying to London. So we would love to know your ideas. Did we hit the nail on the head with what we covered today? And then before we go into next week, do you have any preconceived notions you want us to address? I don't know when we're going to record that, but it'll be a few days after this comes out probably. So would love to hear people's opinions. And then certainly after next week, we want to have a conversation about this.
Yeah, guys, we appreciate you sticking around. We appreciate the new Patreon folks and the new reviews. That's a great way to help us get the word about what we're going to be doing coming up.
And to give us feedback. Let us know case suggestions and your opinions on what you think specifically about cases like this. But we appreciate you listening to us, and we look forward to next week's conversation.
And until next crime, this has been True Crimecast.
You've listened to True Crimecast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.